Okay, residents, the lady of the house speaking. Oh, it's you, Violet. It's my sister, Violet. She's the one with the adopted black daughter, the transgender son, and money for a child with Down syndrome. Married a professor of gender studies. Very well connected. Which is what, dear? He's going around the town saying that race is a biological construct. You must do something about it, Violet. I've turned this way, Elizabeth. It's time to go. It was lovely to see you. Hello, and welcome to this edition of the Jolly Heretic. Now, today I would like to talk about why we as a people are coming apart. That was a reference to the late 1980s, early 1990s comedy, Keeping Up Appearances. And what it was about was a middle-class woman from a working-class background who was a snob, Hyacinthe Bouquet. Hyacinthe Bouquet has three sisters. There's Rose and Daisy, and they live on a council estate, what in America you would call a project. They're extremely poor and they're working class. And she spends all her time, and they're married, and Daisy has a husband, Onslow, and Rose is basically a bit of a tart, a bit loose and unmarried. And she spends all of her time being embarrassed by them and trying to avoid them. And she spends the other half of her time trying to socially climb and trying to make herself look more upper middle class than she is. She is particularly impressed by her older sister, Violet, because Violet has married a turf accountant and has a swimming pool and room for a pony and is very, very successful and much wealthier than her. And she looks up to Violet, but there's all kinds of problems beneath the surface because it turns out that Violet's husband, Bruce, is a homosexual or a transvestite or something and goes around doing all kinds of embarrassing things. She is married to her long-suffering husband, Richard, Richard Bucket, though she insists on pronouncing it Bouquet because she's a snob. The plot is always based around her attempts to seem frightfully middle class and to get on with the vicar and to seem aristocratic and whatever, and this being subverted by her working class family or her embarrassing brother-in-law, Bruce, or whatever. Now, that plot, that whole system, makes a great deal of sense in the England of the 1980s and the 1970s, but it makes a lot less sense now. Because the England and also the America of the 1970s, 1980s, it was a bit sort of anachronistic even when it was being made, was very much a united culture, a united society in which the culture of people, no matter what social class they were, whether they were upper class or whether they were working class, was quite similar. They were all Church of England. Whether it's Hyacinth's working class family, Onslow and Daisy and Rose, they are interested in the vicar and in the Church of England for occasional rituals and things like that. They're all Church of England, they're all English, they're all white, they all have broadly the same values and broadly the same way of seeing the world. And you have the upper class at the top that you look up to and you imitate. Hyacinth imitates those people. It's called a trickle effect, called George Simmel, the German sociologist, trickle effect. So that she imitates them, but she does because she wants to be like them, but she does so in an over-the-top, ostentatious fashion, the over-the-top posh voice, okay, residents, and all this sort of thing. And then the people at the bottom of society, they also to some extent, what is at the top drips down to them. So they wear sports clothes and things like this, and these have started at the top and they've moved down over the years and become associated with the working class and whatever. And there's basically this whole of Hyacinth's character is based around social embarrassment at her modest origins that she's trying to overcome. But she's part of a system. She respects the upper class. She looks down on the working class. And she tries to be better than she is in a culture in which everyone has the same culture. It's like the village, the stereotypical English village, where there's lots of different social classes and they all kind of get on to some extent. There's conflict between them, but they all have roughly the same culture. Now, in both America and in Britain, over the last 50 years, this system has come apart, has fallen apart, such that the culture which bound us all together has collapsed, and the society has segregated, has polarized into a number of quite separate cultures. And I want to look at this today. A very interesting book on this subject with reference to America was published some years ago by Charles Murray, and it's called Simply Coming Apart. Now, he argues that the turning point was the 21st of November 1963, which was the assassination of JFK. On that date, you had a strongly united society in which everybody in America was overwhelmingly the same. The Beverly Hillbillies, which was a TV program, was watched by 34.9% of the population. 93% of the population had a television, and there were only four channels, and so they were completely united. And you imagine that, you have a third of the population watching one television program. By the year 2010, 9% of the population watched the Idol pop song thing, and that was considered good. You had the top 40 records or whatever that were on that week, and that was it, and that was what everyone listened to. You had the things that were on TV, and you either watched them live or you missed them. Everybody basically had Christian values. It didn't matter whether they were upper class or whether they were working class. Everybody, almost everybody, christened their kids, and 50%, half of the population went to church, and those which didn't strongly believed in Christian values. Only 3.5% of households were led by a divorcee, because divorces were completely unacceptable. 80% of women, like Hyacinth, were housewives. There was a clear system. You have this, by the way, in Keeping Up Appearances. Daisy is a housewife. Violet is a housewife. That's why it's anachronistic. Hyacinth is a housewife, and the husband goes out to work. And that's the system. And there's no deviation from that. The level of crime, and this is something that's also true of Keeping Up Appearances. There's no crime. It's a wonderland in that way. There are only 18 per 100,000 arrests for drugs, as against 1,284 for drink. These are hugely gone up in the intervening years. You have extreme class differences, but there is, but they're not as pronounced as now financially or culturally, and there's a strong kinship between people. And this has now very much changed. Now, what is it that has changed it? What is it that's altered this system so that we have come apart? Well, there's two things, or three interrelated factors, I think, that have altered it. The first is meritocracy, and this is what Charles Murray looks at, and sort of geographical movements. The second is the collapse of religiousness, and the third, I think, is basically the consequences, writ large, of genetic changes in the population. Now, if we look at what he looks at, which is the what meritocracy has done. What meritocracy has done is it's gone from a situation where there was very limited social movement. The heritability of socioeconomic status is overall has been found to be something like 0.7, something like that. So there was very limited social movement. People tended to stay, they were attached to the land, and they tended to stay in their own village or their own area, and they didn't move about. Now, with the rise of meritocracy, and also with the rise of better transport links, people are better able to move about. What that leads to is cognitive stratification, whereby intelligent people find each other. Intelligent people who were born in some small, in Iowa or somewhere like that, will find their way to the elite colleges in the east of America, will find their way to the best schools. They will find each other. He notes that in the place where he's from, Charles Murray, Des Moines, Iowa, you would have the wealthy areas, you'd have the poorer areas, the middle class areas, the working class areas, and they would all be quite similar to each other in a lot of ways. They sort of live side by side. And this is not the case anymore. You have an alteration in the nature of where people live, such that you have entire areas of the country where the more intelligent migrate to and find other more intelligent people, and you have entire areas of large cities like New York, where again the more intelligent people, the educated people, find their way and they meet other people, and so they increasingly have nothing to do with people that are socioeconomically different. You increasingly have nothing to do with people who think differently from you, who are of a lower socioeconomic, a lower sort of social class than you. You're not going to know those people. You're not going to talk to them on a day-to-day basis. And so in that sense, therefore, you start to develop a separate culture, a separate way of seeing the world. Whereas once in the 1960s, there's one television channel or four television channels, there's hardly any diversity, hardly any restaurants, anything like that. Then this all comes apart as the society moves in due to this cognitive stratification people move away from each other. And this is what he charts. And so you end up with a situation where more intelligent people come into contact with yet more intelligent people, and they create their own separate culture. He calls these people the blue bohemians, the educated class. So they are a narrow elite. They watch things like Frasier. They're interested in things like, these people, they have left-wing liberal values. They're not religious. They don't hold to the traditional way of doing things. They hang around with other people who are like them. And before long, they have very little to do with the kind of America that is the red states that votes Republican, where in many cases, they may have come from. They have nothing to do with them at all. They then go into professions such as the technology and things like this, which value brains. These create increasingly elite salaries, and the fact that they have more money means, again, they have nothing to do with the lifestyle of people that are much poorer in a way that wasn't the case in the past. They move to different areas of the country. They gentrify different areas of the city. They have a completely different value set, whereby they seem to value marriage more than the working class, but they also value other things. You know, it's okay for women to have careers and whatever. And so increasingly you get this separation. So Manhattan, example, he gives the example, utterly gentrified. In 1963, 40% of people in Manhattan were doing industrial jobs. Now it's 5%, and increasingly people that live in Manhattan are extremely wealthy and are completely separated in their culture and in the way they live life from the what you would traditionally call the working class. They are the things that would bind them together are gone. The working class would traditionally be the ones that would be believing in traditional values and whatever that were the dominant values of the 1960s. These are completely gone. And worse than that, you then, at the other extreme, have a collapse in control over the working class. So the working class also are no longer being, as it were, sort of inspired to be moral or whatever by the upper class, because they have nothing to do with them. So they're not being controlled by them. They don't see them as part of their world. They don't see them as people to imitate. They're completely separate from them, and they see them as totally separate. And so he charts this collapse in traditional values among the working class as well. Not traditional values in terms of attitudes to immigrants or attitude whatever, but traditional values in terms of sex. So therefore marriage has collapsed among the working class, huge rise in illegitimacy among the working class, huge rise in joblessness among the working class, and sort of generations of joblessness and things like that. And so you get a huge rise in drug use and all this sort of thing. And so you get this extreme difference between different social classes based on the rise of meritocracy and the constant cognitive stratification. Now, another issue which he doesn't look at so much, which is also going to make things more difficult, is the issue of immigration. What immigration does, according to Robert Putnam, is it reduces social trust. So people stop, it reduces social trust because people will tend to, for biological reasons, to want to cooperate with people that are more genetically similar to themselves. So it's a way of indirectly passing on your more of your genes. And so if you have an ethnically diverse society, there's less social trust. People are less inclined to invest in the society as a whole because they are investing less in their genetic interests as a whole. So social trust declines. And this is going to help exaggerate these differences between social classes and exaggerate a sense of distrust, a sense of which a person of a different class is different from me and I don't trust them, because there is simply less social trust. What makes this situation worse is that once you get ethnic diversity, then also you get a perception, you get distrust even among the natives, because there becomes this increasing perception that another native could collaborate against my interests with the foreigners, and therefore I don't trust them and I won't invest in them. This is what you see as well. And I think there is a perception on the part of the white working class in America and Britain that that's exactly what's happened, because there is a tendency for the upper class to advocate multiculturalism as a means of virtue signaling, as a means of elevating their own status, as a means of implying that they're really kind people and therefore you should give them
money and give them status and look up to them. That's exactly what they do. They use this system as a means of helping to elevate their own status, and they denigrate those that don't agree with it. And also they advocate the ideology very clearly of multiculturalism while they can afford to live in areas that are not multicultural. And so this helps to reduce social trust even more. And so it helps to break the bond, if you like, the noblesse oblige bond between the upper class and the working class. Whereas once in 1963, the working class would sort of look up to the upper class, and the upper class would have a sort of paternalistic attitude towards the working class as people whom they should, who were low intelligence and sort of potentially low morals, and therefore they should look after them in an overarching system of religiosity. This sort of goes away. There's a separation between them, and Murray points out that you have an increasing view whereby the upper class regard the working, or the upper middle class anyway, regard the working class as just degenerate and revolting and ghastly and totally different from them, and not part of one overall kindred family. And the upper class, the working class, regard the upper class or the upper middle class similarly as different from them, and vile and ghastly and degenerate and treacherous and not part of one kindred family, because they've started to, for these different reasons, because they've come apart. They're no longer living side by side. They're no longer living in the same places. They're no longer interacting with each other. They've developed separate cultures for this reason, because it's a self-perpetuating process whereby you only have anything to do with people that are more similar to you, that you have this separation. And he doesn't look at so much at the internet, but the internet kind of makes it worse, because it makes it even easier for you to find people who are similar to you, and to only interact with people who are similar genetically. If you have similar opinions, by the way, on average you're likely to be genetically more similar, who are similar to you. So you have this separation, this polarization between social classes that happens for that reason as well. Now, another factor that's also relevant is the collapse of religiousness. Now, what does it predict religiousness? Well, one of the things that predicts religiousness is stress, and particularly mortality salience. Well, this has gone down since the 1960s. It's gone down a fair bit. I mean, child mortality is now 1%. It was a little bit higher than that in the 1960s. This makes people less religious. Now, what the religion tends to do is it tends to promote, as the will of God, really kind of group selected values. So it promotes the idea that we're all Christians, we can trust each other because we're Christians. God wants us to behave in a moral, pro-social way for the good of the community and for the good of the group, and the group is blessed by God, and therefore you should all be kind to each other, and you can all trust each other because you all believe in God, and you all have the same fundamental views based around the reality of God and various dogmas. That's the idea of Christianity. Now, you see the collapse of Christianity between the 1960s and now. 50% or more church attendance starts to go down. People become less religious. They become less controlled by the religion, and therefore they have less of a reason to trust each other, because traditionally you could say, oh, well, you know, I'm a Christian, he's a Christian, we believe in the same things, we believe in the same God, we have the same eternal destiny, we're bound up together in an eternal way. Our group, the American people, is blessed by God, and we're bound up you're together, and it's God's will, and you know, there's this eternal idea of Americanness, and therefore we should cooperate for God, you know, good of God, and all this sort of thing. There's a little house on the prairie way of seeing the world. Or this, with the collapse of religiousness, this of course gradually falls apart, and so there's less reason to trust each other as fellow co-religionists. There's less reason, because you don't believe in the same things anymore. There's less reason to be part of one group. There's less reason to perceive your group as eternally important. There's less reason to perceive it as eternally important that you should cooperate with and love members of your own group and who are Christian. And so therefore the group starts to fall apart for that reason as well. Then we can look at, and I think this is perhaps the most significant issue, which Charles Murray does not look at all, and I think this is very important, at the genetic issue. Now, if you look at a group such as the genetic changes that have happened, we have to remember that under harsh Darwinian conditions, which were present until 1800, there was 50% child mortality, another 40% of people didn't breed for various reasons, and so only 10% of people passed on their genes. And these were the most genetically fit people that passed on their genes. These people were extremely genetically fit, they were immune to childhood disease and things like this. What we were selecting for were traits which were pro-social. Our trait we were selecting for religiousness. We know that religiousness is about 0.4 genetic. Being fundamentalist, very religious, is about 0.7 genetic. It's associated with fertility. It's associated with genetic physical health. It's associated with genetic mental health. There are specific parts of the brain which, if you stimulate them with magnets, it makes you both more ethnocentric and more religious, and so therefore it's associated with group selection, because the group that's higher in positive and negative ethnocentrism is, according to computer models, is more likely to win in the battle of group selection. So it's associated with group selection level doing well. So it's definitely under selection, religiousness. Intelligence, we know we were selecting for that. So all of these things we were selecting for, and you had this group of people that were about 10% of the population now that were extremely healthy and had basically a very small gene pool, because they were adapted to this niche. And if you deviated from it because it was so harsh, then you die out. Now, with the Industrial Revolution, this changes, because of course you have the rise of better living standards, inoculations, better medicine, all this sort of thing. And so you have the result of that is massive genetic diversity. And the brain, as I've said so many times, is 84% of the genome. So if you're getting greater genetic diversity, greater mutational load, basically more and more people who would have died out under Darwinian conditions because they had mutations, which meant they had a poor immune system, well, that would parallel mutations of the mind. Because if you've got mutations of the body, well, the mind's 84% of the genome, so you're bound to have mutations of the mind. So it means that industrialization results in greater and greater and greater mental diversity, in more and more people deviating from the way of thinking to which we were selected under these harsh Darwinian conditions, therefore deviating from believing in a moral god, deviating from wanting to collectively worship a moral god, which is what was the norm then, deviating from high intelligence, which is what was the norm then, deviating from pro-social, highly pro-social cooperative sort of personality, deviating from all of these things, deviating from mental health, deviating from all of these things which were being selected for. And we know, by the way, that having poor mental health correlates with having values which would have been anathema in 1800, such as putting another family before your own, another ethnic group before your own, another species before your own, and whatever. All of these left-wing values, multiculturalism, environmentalism, socialism, whatever, they're all associated with evidence of mutational load, i.e. with which mental illness is. And they're even associated with evidence of physical mutational load, because, for example, being left-wing, people have physically less attractive faces than people who are right-wing. Why is that the case? Well, because if you have an attractive face, then you have low mutational load, which means your face is symmetrical, and it looks pleasant. It's high mutational load means you have an asymmetrical face. You haven't been able to maintain a symmetrical phenotype in the face of disease and whatever, because you have higher mutational load. And this is going to be associated with other evidence of higher mutational load, such as mutational load of the mind. And this is going to be associated with deviations from the way of thinking that was present when our level of mutational load was extremely low. So it makes sense. That's why, of course, all these people that are photographed from Oregon who are Antifa or whatever are so bloody ugly. So what you get then is this greater genetic diversity. Now, what that's going to lead to, of course, is a coming apart. But what else would it lead to? I mean, if you look at what peoples are like when the level of selection is weak, such where it's hot all the time, where basic needs are met, where, you know, there's food all the time, the level of selection under, let's say, the Yanomama of Venezuela is extremely weak. Well, they're extremely genetically diverse, and because they're extremely genetically diverse, they don't get on with each other. They are unable to create complex societies, because complex societies, the cooperation is based around genetic similarity. We are more likely to cooperate with people who are genetically similar to ourselves. There's huge amounts of data on this. We get on better with siblings, even with families that are more genetically similar to ourselves. We get on better with our friends are more genetically similar to each other than could be the case by chance. Couples that get married are more genetically similar to each other than could be the case by chance. We select to be with people that are genetically similar to ourselves. And so the more genetically diverse the people, forgetting immigration, forget that, that's just another factor that is going to perpetuate the problem. But even if there was no immigration, the more genetically diverse the people become, the more they're going to come apart, the more there's going to be polarization, the more there will be completely separate cultures that are completely separate from each other. And that is what we are seeing now. That's why this polarization is happening, because we are so genetically diverse, and therefore you just get, and the system of meritocracy means we are able to find people much more easily who are genetically similar to us, thus creating ever greater polarization. Now, it could be argued that this problem of huge diversity was held back at the environmental level by religiousness. People, even while this process was occurring, we were indoctrinated with these religious values, and we had sufficient mortality salience that we were religious, and the religious held us together. But there came a tipping point where the religiousness, and this was probably 1963, in England we say, there's a poem by Philip Larkin, Sex Came Rather Late for Me in 1963, somewhere between the end of the Chatterley Ball and the Beatles' first LP. There's something about 1963 that was the tipping point. Because what you would predict is that you would get more and more and more people who were these with high mutational load, with values that were very different from the religious values to which we were adapted. We can call them spiteful mutants, who would push society in a maladaptive direction, who would be in favour of individualism, who would be in favour of helping foreigners over the nation, who would be in favour of these values that are negatively associated with fertility, negatively associated with group dominance, negatively associated with group fertility. And they would increase the population, but they wouldn't be able to express themselves because the population would still be strongly religious and would still maintain these binding values, these values that were adaptive under conditions of harsh selection. And eventually they would reach a tipping point of about 20 or 25% of population. And it's been found that that is the tipping point. And once a minority, according to experiments, reaches about 20%. Experiments have been shown have shown this, that, you know, you'll ask a person a question and they'll say the right answer, and then once 25% of the group start saying the wrong answer, then people will migrate over to them, because they will see them as, well, they must be correct, and they will see them as the winning team, and you want to be on the winning team. And the tipping point is about 20-25%. I think what happened in 1963 was they reached that 25% of the population, that critical mass. And once these mutants, these maladaptive people, reach the critical mass, then people migrate over to them en masse. And that becomes the dominant culture. And so now you have a situation where you have these spiteful mutants who push society in a maladaptive direction, who make the correct way of seeing the world the way of seeing the world that is not the adaptive way of seeing the world, which is what was going on before 1963, but is a maladaptive way of seeing the world. So a way of seeing the world that says you should put other groups before your own, other families before your own, other species before your own, that there's and that messes up the socialization of children, tells them there's no such thing as sex, no such thing as gender, whatever, confuses them, and generally messes them up. And so that's what seems to have happened. And then you have a new upper middle class on that basis, where they attain status by taking those maladaptive ideas in a more and more and more extreme direction, by taking the status quo, the woke status quo, in a more and more extreme direction. So then it becomes, oh, that we need to have more diversity in terms of ethnicity, fine. Then in terms of sexuality, fine. Then even in terms of disability. And there was one woman who Sally Phillips, her name is, who did a program arguing that you shouldn't abort children that have Down syndrome, because it's diversity. It's good to have diversity. And it's diversity to have people that have a serious chromosomal disorder. And then it becomes a sign of being working class, because people who are working class, they're lower IQ, they're less able to understand the benefits of adopting the dominant culture. They have lower IQ, so they're more kind of instinctive. And so therefore they are less woke and more inclined to abort a Down syndrome child. And those that are more upper middle class, they realize they can express their wokeness and how left wing they are and how committed they are to the new ideology by not doing so. And so those people become, as it were, as Jim Goad has called them, the new church ladies, the new, that's what Hyacinth was, the new snobs. And being a snob is no longer based around what was snobbery in the 1960s. It's no longer based around the Rolls Royce and the yacht and all of these sorts of signs. Then yes, there's a subgroup within the upper middle class that has maintained these traditional values. So there is still snobbery associated with that. But basically, then you've got this separate culture that's developed. very different among the upper middle class, where snobbery is now that you have an autistic child, or you have a transgender child, or you have a you bring the child up as neither boy nor girl, or you adopt a child of a different race or whatever. And this is the new snobbery. And it's a very interesting, and I expect it to progress. Whereas once a parent might want their child to have a friend whose father was a barrister, or have a friend whose father had a title. Now that snob would want their child to have a friend who was black, or a friend who was disabled, or a friend who had Down syndrome, because that gives you bragging rights, because it's an inversion of normal values, where bad becomes good, where negative becomes positive, where maladaptive becomes adaptive, and where you gain social status by doing things, ironically, which are bad for you. And that has happened because of the collapse of selection pressure, such that we have a tipping point of people with maladaptive, damaging ideas, and then those who are less maladaptive, but still with some mutational load, are not protected psychologically against these ideas, and therefore can be inculcated with them. And all you have is a shrinking minority of the population who are very, very religious, and who are basically the remnant normal 10% who would have survived under Darwinian conditions, who are, for genetic reasons, I think, immune from these ideas and can't be inculcated by them. But of course, those people are the people that are having children. So it's unlikely that this situation will last forever. Okay, well, I hope it's been of interest. If it has, then please feel free to help support the channel, which you will see ways you can do so in the box below, through Entropy, through whatever you want to do. I live stream on Mondays and Thursdays at 7 p.m. UK time, 2 p.m. New York, at the Jolly Heretic Public House, so please join me then. And thank you for listening, and I will see you soon, and goodbye!